Welcome to In Gad We Trust, a podcast based in and around classic era, golden age detective fiction of the 1920s to the 1940s. My name is Jim, I blog at The Invisible Event, and the plan for this podcast is that each episode features me in conversation with fellow bloggers, with authors, with enthusiasts in the genre, to talk about a topic of their choosing. Joining me for this episode is John Norris, who blogs at Pretty Sinister. John, welcome to In Gad We Trust.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Jim.
When I asked people to suggest topics that they might be interested in talking about, one of the things you came back to me with was magic and magicians in Golden Age detective fiction. What sort of thing, then, are we going to be talking about today?
Okay, well, the idea of misdirection in detective fiction is kind of paramount and key to the whole structure and delight in reading it. We open up a book and we enter the world of these murderers and detectives hoping to be fooled. And this is also something that is very similar to how magicians work. We go to a magic show because we want to see a woman float up into the air and then disappeared. How did he do it? So that's basically what I like when I encounter magic and magicians in detective fiction, because they know sleight of hand and they know illusions and they know how to make you look at something that you shouldn't be looking at while he's doing something completely different to play the trick on you. That's detective fiction is a magic show on paper, and it doesn't necessarily have to include magic, but when it does, it's even more exciting and thrilling, at least for me. I've been fascinated with magic, stage magic, since I was a kid. I used to do magic shows. And they were gory. We stuck Lisa Hunnell, the girl next door, my little brother's friend, in a box and put barbecue skewers in it, and then we tried to disappear people and all this other kind of stuff. So the first Broadway musical I ever saw was The Magic Show with Doug Henning, who is a very popular stage magician, Canadian, very popular stage magician who is on TV a lot, and then they wrote this Broadway musical for him. And I have tons of books about magicians. I was obsessed with Houdini when I was like 11 years old, and then I started learning about all the rest of them, Keller and Thurston, Dunninger. I have a collection of posters of magicians that I've been forced to take off the wall because they're too macabre. Anyway, it's been with me all my life. And when I started reading detective fiction and collecting it, I found this whole subsection of magicians who are detectives, and also magicians who, like Clayton Rawson, everybody probably knows him, the great Merlini, who created, who wrote the detective fiction. So magicians who were writers, and it wasn't just Clayton Rawson. There were quite a few of them. And just for this podcast, as a matter of fact, I found a whole secret life to a writer who I knew as a mystery writer, but didn't even know that he was also one of these magician writers who we'll most likely talk about later. That's pretty much where I'm coming from here and why I thought it would be a really interesting topic for everybody to hear about. Because most of the time when we are writing our reviews and talking about mystery fiction, it's the plots and the amazing gimmicks and conventions and tricks that just kind of blow us away. And I know that phrases like pull the rug from under me and pull the wool over my eyes pop up a lot when I'm writing these reviews. And I like to be fooled. I like to gasp. I like to go, oh, you did it. You did it. I got fooled.
I'm a huge fan of impossible crime fiction. And there is definitely that overlap with the impossible crime am with magic, because I think it's fair to say, I don't think either of us believes that magic is real. But I think that there's that thing with an impossible crime where obviously one of the philosophical problems with the impossible crime is obviously it can't be impossible or else it wouldn't have happened.
Exactly.
And so you go into an impossible crime knowing that you're going to be fooled to a certain extent, and you're looking for the way in which you're being fooled in the same way that most people, I would have thought, go to a magic show not believing that magic is real and nevertheless still wanting to be fooled. And as you say, there's that element then that extends into just detective fiction of, having the wool completely pulled over your eyes because you want to solve it, you want to be ahead of the writer so that you can feel smug and clever about yourself.
Yeah.
But there is that lovely moment where you get to go, oh, no, I did not see that coming.
Yeah, right. I was like, oh, shoot, I should have known better. So there are two little things that I wanted to give an example of. In Footprints on the Ceiling, towards the very end, after almost the entire solution has been presented, the great Merlini, who's the detective in the piece, and he's a magician, says that the footprints on the ceiling had no actual connection with the murders themselves, and yet they were very appropriate symbols of the misdirection such and such character used. Misdirection is nothing more than psychology turned upside down and inside out. And now he gets very kind of didactic. The principles of deception, whether used by murderer, magician, or mystery story writer, are only the orthodox textbook psychological laws of attention, observation, and thought working in reverse. So I like the fact that he comes out and actually talks about that aspect. It may or may not appear in other books in the series. There are only four novels, and I've read three of them so far. And there's another view of misdirection described by a writer named Ken Crossan, who's used multiple identities when he's been writing his mystery fiction. He started out as a pulp fiction writer, and this book, Murder Out of Mind, extremely hard to find, is one of these paperback originals that was published in digest format by a very short-lived company called Five Star Mystery. And he talks about misdirection also. There is a magician character. He's not the detective. The detective is Sharaman Fuzzy Van Dyke. He goes by the nickname Fuzzy. He's an immensely overweight, opinionated, rude, irreverent, insulting man who is a gossip columnist on the radio. And at one point, the magician says, at the very end, everything's been solved, and the magician says to Van Dyke, "You were right, Fuzzy, in saying that I should have caught that. Such a thing is practically impossible, but everyone's attention was focused on the murder." And Van Dyke says, "Misdirection, you call it, when you do one of those miserable tricks of yours." So it's the magician writers like to talk about the tricks that the magicians employ. They also tend to put magicians in their stories, and this analogy of the misdirection, which is sleight of hand and whatnot on the stage, comes in very handy to explain how these clever manipulative murderers almost get away with their crimes. So a lot of these magician detectives appear in pulp magazine stories, and there is Maxwell Grant, the pseudonym of Walter Gibson, who was a magician, who personally knew he knew almost all of the greats of the American stage, the Houdini, Keller, Thurston, all these other people that I had mentioned that I was enamored of when I was a kid. Maxwell Grant was also the Gibson, writing as Maxwell Grant, created The Shadow knows Lamont Cranston, The Shadow. Mm-hmm. So he's much better known for that. But he created a character called, and now here we go, it's the pronunciation game. So the character is N-O-R-G-I-L. I personally prefer Norgil, but I guess a lot of people will say Norgil. I really don't know. It happens to be an anagram, his stage name, because his real name is Loring, L-O-R-I-N-G. He is a stage magician who has a knack for encountering professional criminals. I mean, the pages of these stories are just filled with gangsters and con artists. And these stories are very action-oriented. Almost all of the stories in pulp magazines are more about adventure, shoot 'em up, fist fights, all that kind of stuff. This one collection that I found, it's subtitled More Tales of Prestidigitation. And that was great. I liked that. So we have 8 different stories in here. They're not really murder mysteries. They have miracle problems, disappearing objects and robberies and disappearing people and supernatural, apparently supernatural elements, which of course would then be rationalized and explained in the final scenes. What's interesting is that he has recurring characters. So Norgil has his whole crew, Miriam, his stage assistant, who seems in the first couple of stories to be just the token woman, because these stories are just, 90% men. And, if they need a woman, it's like the decoration. So...
Or someone get kidnapped and tied up to motivate the hero.
Yeah, right. Or a damsel that needs to be put into distress, right? Yeah. And she comes into her own in some of the later stories, and in Murder in Wax, one of the few stories that has an actual death, she is doing some female sleuthing on her own, and that was nice to see. So these were interesting adventure stories that incorporate tricks and illusions as part of the crime solving, or actually in some cases he Norgil employs the tricks to capture. So that's the idea of what's going on in early detective fiction. Those were written in the 1930s. In fact, they appeared only in 1 year, from August 38 to July 39. And the total number of stories there were only 23 with this character, Norgil the Magician. I guess the real surprise for me was discovering the pulp writing of Fulton Orsler, who wrote as Anthony Abbott. He did the Thatcher Colt detective novels, and those appeared in the 30s, the late 30s. But this book that I found called The Magician Detective and Other Weird Mysteries is a collection of his short stories, and some of them are just vignettes and that appeared in a variety of pulp magazines. There's a huge, extremely detailed biographical introduction to this collection, where I learned all of this stuff about Fulton Orsler, who wrote as Charles Fulton Orsler when he was in his 30s. And so there's these unusual vignettes, as I said, and short stories. And in one case, the title piece, The Magician Detective, is a novella. It's very, very long and plot-oriented, unlike some of these other vignettes. And these were very indicative of the kind of early 20th century American writing of mystery fiction. It's kind of shallow, and it's not very sophisticated, and filled with lots of stereotypical, what we now consider stereotypical features, and the dialogue is very much like things that you would read in what we think of as juvenile fiction. I was very disappointed with almost everything that I read in this book. Some of the details in this story, which was called The Mystery of the Seven Shadows, were just bizarre. Like, he has a crime lab in his house, and it's got an entire menagerie, right? So there's snakes and rabbits, but at one point he says in the story, "I'm not a scientist," and yet he's got this laboratory. You know, it's like, "I'm not a scientist. I'm a man of logic." So these are the stories that we get in the early 20th century. It's very much, you know, what E.F. Blyler liked to call commercial fiction. It's very geared towards the masses, and it's all entertainment. It's all fantasy. It's highly imaginative, and yet, in being highly imaginative, it also is repetitive in using all of these conventions over and over that have been around for, you know, centuries. It's a kind of recycling of things you found in sensation fiction in the Victorian era carries on into the early 20th century. And then eventually you get somebody who is innovative in some way, and then they just emulate one another and mimic each other. And yeah.
The thing I'm interested to unpack in all of this is you start off talking about misdirection.
Yes.
How misdirection is very key to these principles of detective fiction. And then we have these very early 20th century pulp stories. As you say, they're very action-oriented. And obviously, this is at a point where the detective genre is still, it's very nascent, it's very callow. They don't really have these principles of, certainly of cluing or of fair play, or of the need to distract the reader from something. And it's fair to say, is it not, that in pulp stories, the recurrent themes are the damsel in distress, the punch-up.
Yes.
So this is a long time before you've got the accepted tropes of detective fiction, of these need to clue and to misdirect away from certain plot elements or aspects. Which way around does it work? Is it the fact that these stories are very pulpy means that they have come out in the early 20th century, or is it the fact they've come out in the early 20th century means they're very pulpy? Because currently, at the time of writing, there's no sort of higher misdirection standard to aspire to, is there?
Oh, you're comparing the lack of misdirection in contemporary fiction? Yeah, I don't know.
The relative simplicity of them, it seems to me, comes from the fact that at this early stage, misdirection isn't really a thing yet, right?
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. You're right. It was mostly in the examples that I've found. I was hoping to see that similar to what I've experienced with magicians as detectives, that they use their skills to solve the crimes, or the magician uses his talents and his knowledge of illusion to entrap a murderer, so that actually the tricks are appear in the context of the story. That's what I was hoping to find in the Orsler stories, but I pretty much found that it was just the kind of typical formulaic mysterious problem, and then examination of it in that kind of Holmesian way. The misdirection aspect of detective fiction and mystery fiction comes about through I don't even know who we can really attribute it to.
It seems to me that the flip side of those sorts of magic tricks being used as a way to trap the criminal, if you look at, for instance, you mentioned Clayton Rawson earlier, it seems to me one of the things that I find slightly frustrating with Rawson is how he will throw in, for instance, Mellini doing a magic trick purely for the sake of doing a magic trick that has no bearing on the plot.
Yeah, that's correct, yes.
He's, you know, eternally making stuff appear and disappear, or from another world where he does, or is it Off the Face of the Earth? No, it's Off the Face of the Earth, where he demonstrates the vanishing illusion to Ross Hart early on. And it's never explained. And Ross Hart goes, "Oh, is there a chance, you know, later on when someone vanishes from a phone box, is there a chance that your vanishing illusion could work?" And he just goes, "Nope, move on." And you as a reader are never given the chance to engage with that. And I'm quite interested at the point at which that changes, at which the magic becomes, in these pulp stories, sort of integral to what's going on, to Rawson using it as almost a complete throwaway, because a lot of the time Mellini being a detective is almost immaterial.
Right. He's more of a, he just, it's that he has knowledge that other people don't have. He lectures a lot in those books, and he uses that knowledge to and applies it to the mysterious circumstances of the story. There's in a kind of Kolchak the Night Stalker kind of way, something that's we see a lot later. Although he doesn't have the knowledge, he's kind of more of a researcher. He says, "Oh yeah." But that's something that is a convention that was started earlier and then carried on later in mystery and detective fiction. I didn't sit down and think about the evolution of it, the misdirection that we so enjoy and we want to figure it out. But at least for me, there's the actually a higher pleasure level when you are fooled. I guess the 20s in more in the longer form in the novels rather than in the short stories, the novels of the 20s and the early 30s are replete with mysterious circumstances. I think in some cases, I just read the Upfold Farm Mystery, and that's A. Fielding. The detective is Inspector Pointer. That plot is just amazingly labyrinthian in its intricacy, and there is an element in that story is that an accident creates all of the mystery, a sheer accident, and not so much that people are covering up or lying and deceit, but that's a use of accidental misdirection that gets employed a lot later in by some of the masters of plotting. That's a different element altogether.
Yeah, there's an Ellery Queen novel, which is ostensibly an impossible crime purely on account of that sort of accident or coincidence. And so you do see this recurrent theme as a style of misdirection. I always find that slightly less satisfying because if you take misdirection and magic as that sort of parallel, no one wants a magic trick to have sort of happened by accident. You know, you want to feel as if you could have had the opportunity to anticipate it or to see it. I always feel a bit as if using coincidence or using accident as a form of misdirection or in order to make something mysterious. I always feel, I've got to be honest, I feel a little bit cheated when that happens. Maybe that's just me. In terms of talking about magicians, we should probably talk about, in that case, Rim of the Pit by Hake Talbot.
Oh, yes.
Because Talbot, of course, himself was a magician.
He
His
was.
real name was Henning Nelms, and he wrote two novels and, as far as we're aware, two short stories under the name of Hake Talbot. Rim of the Pit, I think, is broadly accepted as the crowning achievement on his detective fiction career. I mean, the couple of short stories, The Other Side is, you know, it's fine, but it's not especially memorable. He wrote one called The High House, which, I mean, I don't rate. I didn't think it was that good, but that might in part be because his two novels, what is it, The Hangman's Handyman and Rim of the Pit, are just so very redolent in, I think, pretty much everything we'd hope from impossible crime novels by a magician featuring a magician.
Right, yes.
And I mean, we probably, no, we shouldn't get into spoilers, but there is a lovely dual element in Rim of the Pit as how the various impossibilities unfold because you have a character we discover at the end adding a layer of complexity and of the sort of intangible and the eldritch to a lot of what unfurls.
Yes. And that book also features something that is very common in the mystery novels and detective novels that have magic, and that is a séance scene and the idea of spiritualism and is it real? Is it fake? Is this a con artist? Or that was a recurring theme that I found in some of the Orsler stories, and of course Ross writes about it too.
Yeah, I've got to be honest. I am a huge fan of a fictional seance. I do love. I mean, I would consider calling it a fraudulent seance to be a pleonasm because by dint of the fact that it's a seance, it has to be fraudulent as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
But I have written a post in which I put in like five of my favorite seances in fiction because I love the various ways in which the seance can be used or can be misused.
Right.
To set tone, to tell you a lot about the characters. The one in Rim of the Pit is very, very good, and it contains some very clever ideas. Like, I love, in fact, Rim of the Pit is a lovely counterpoint to Merlini, and the way in which Merlini consistently breaks out these magic trips that are not explained. I don't think any trick or any mummery or any form of misdirection or having, you know, sand thrown in your eyes, I don't think anything is employed in Rim of the Pit without being explained, which is one of the things I really like about that book. The lady leading the seance almost suffocates because she falls over or she faints.
Right.
Because she faints with her shawl over her head, and the shawl is lined with a particular material so that she can use a torch when she's hidden under the shawl to read notes and things like this.
Yes.
I love the way in which those little details, which I think Rawson and Merlini would throw in and not explain, I love the way Talbot goes to the effort to work them into his milieu, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I loved the paranoia of that story as well. I mean, it's a snowbound house story, mystery, and they really are, there's a lot at risk. And there's so many violent things that happen. I mean, there's that tomahawk attack, and everybody, I think, turns detective. I remember that in addition to Rogan Kincaid, the professional gambler, and the Czech magician Vok, there was a woman. I think I have the book here. Yes, I do. Barbara, is it Barbara? And her boyfriend Jeff, they turn detective at one. I mean, everybody's trying to. Really, I swear to God, I remember that she had some keen observations that helped them figure everything out. I like when people are not cowering in the corner, and they accept that in order to put an end to the terror that they're being subjected to, that they take the responsibility to help solve and put an end to it all. That was one of the things that always stuck out in my mind. In addition to all it's overwhelming in the macabre and the impossibilities, the footprints in the snow and whatnot. I'm surprised I don't remember more about it. I really meant to reread the whole thing, but I didn't have any time. I was just like swimming in books and stories. I don't remember reading that post of yours. What were the novels that you listed? Do you remember them all?
The
seance mysteries.
Oh man, I know that probably my favorite fictional seance actually comes from a non-mystery novel. It comes from a science fiction novel called To Say Nothing of the Dog by Connie Willis.
Oh, I have that, but I've never read it.
It is one of my favorite books, I think, that I've read in probably the last decade or so. It is a very, very, very clever, very funny time travel novel where essentially a group of people have to go back in time for reasons that are too complicated to get into here. But there's a magnificent seance scene in that where effectively you have the medium, who is obviously a charlatan, and there is someone else who is trying to influence the seance for their own reasons. And so on one side of things, you have this medium who is clicking and tapping and causing whatever things to happen that she wants to mean what she wants them to mean, and then you have someone else trying to countermand that with their own clicks and taps and ghostly happenings, and you have this sort of spiraling game because the medium is unaware that someone else is trying to Shanghai the seance, and so it becomes this just elaborate comedic farce. the reader is always very aware of what's going on because it's narrated in this third person omniscient voice, so you're told everything that's happening, so there's no element of mystery about it at all. But as sort of an exploration of the seance in fiction, that's probably my favorite. It just cracks me up every time, I think.
Have you read the The Mystery of Friar's Pardon. That's Philip MacDonald writing as Martin Porlock. So that, you know, that has an impossible crime of drowning in a room. But the climax of the story is a séance, and that's my favorite in all of mystery fiction. It's really brilliant. I wrote about the book on my blog very early in the blog, and when I was terse, so it doesn't go into great detail about why I loved it so much. It was just like, wow, that was so cool. A sentence basically, but it still sticks in my brain. Apparently, Christopher St. John Sprigg has a really great novel, detective novel, Six Queer Things, that employs supernatural and seances and a medium, but I've not yet read that, although I've read his others. And one of the interesting things about books with mediums addressed spiritualism for me is the con artist element in it. And of course, magicians were key in debunking the whole spiritualist movement, because it was turning into a horribly exploitive aspect of American crime. And there is a novel that is very... extremely obscure. In fact, it was so obscure it didn't appear in Huben's crime fiction bibliography until like the third revision. Mm-hmm. And it's by Henry Kitchell Webster, of early American mystery writer. He wrote The Whispering Man, which is I think is on one of those lists, one of those Haycraft Queen Cornerstone lists, I think. I've heard of that book, and I went in search of it, and it took me forever to find a copy. But I found The Ghost Girl by Webster through sheer chance. I bought it only because of the title. I knew the author was a mystery writer, and nobody in the world has this book. Every now and then I go, I wonder if there's a Ghost Girl copy out there, and there's like, it's so crazy. But it is it features two detectives. One is a lawyer and one is a portrait painter. And they.
that is an uncommon combination of detectives.
Yeah, isn't that weird? So. But in The Ghost Girl, the painting of the portrait is very key to the plot. Okay. The bulk of the novel, there's a mysterious crime. And it's a horrible, actually, it's kind of ghastly. A woman has been missing for many years, and then a frozen corpse is found in the winter in a river. So this is the mystery of who is she? Are the two linked? And it leads to a spiritualist and a ring of these con artists who are running a seance fraudulent operation. And the most telling part of it is that Webster has some ideas about this. And it's 1913 that this book was published in. Okay. It's during the Renaissance of spiritualism. And in fact, the spiritualist movement was at its peak, I think, right after World War I, because of the great loss of life and casualties in that war. So Webster's addresses the fact that these people are not only criminals and they're exploiting the grief of the individuals. It's very poignant, and there's a deep resentment and a verbally attacking them at one point in the book. It's a recurring theme, this anger. About how horrid this kind of con artistry is, and it's a really really powerful book. Strangely enough, for something that's just really kind of a commercial fiction, I've always wished that was like one of the books on my. I have a list of about 25 books that I've always wanted to reprint, and only because of the way he talks about. How dangerous that crime is to the human psyche was one reason that I've always wanted. I've never found it in any other mystery fiction, detective fiction that includes seances and mediums. I've never found that kind of outrage about how people are being exploited, their grief is being exploited. The closest thing that I found is a book by Mark McShane, and he wrote a book called Seance, which was turned into a very well-known movie, Seance on a Wet Afternoon. That is a woman who, Myra, who believes that she's has the power to communicate with the dead, and involves a child who's been kidnapped. She and her husband kidnap a child and then contact the parents to help them find the girl. But of course, the girl is up in upstairs in a third bedroom. Mm. Well, it's a very tragic crime novel. It's not so much a mystery novel, but it has an astonishing ending that I can never talk about.
Yeah, that's a problem, isn't it?
But but it flips the whole idea of fraudulent supernatural and con artistry in the very final pages, and it just kind of takes your breath away. And there's a tragic element to it in a completely different way than what I just described in The Ghost Girl. Those are the two most powerful uses of spiritualism and contacting the dead in the kind of in crime fiction and detective fiction that I've encountered.
The way you described The Ghost Girl with the body turning up and then they go to consult the medium sounds almost like the inversion of the Anthony Abbott book about the murder of a startled lady.
Oh.
Which is the only Abbott book I read. Having mentioned Abbott earlier, it was just on the top of my head.
Right.
Murder of a Startled Lady I found really interesting because they consult the medium first of all, who tells them where to find the buried remains of a woman who went missing some years previously. And one of the things that I find really interesting about that book is a lot of the time there is rarely any doubt that, as you just described with seance, there's rarely any doubt that the medium is in some way a charlatan, is in some way deserving of this opprobrium, which ends up being directed towards them when they turn out to be a con artist to exploit people. That Abbott book, I didn't particularly like it as a story, but I found it really interesting how for a very long time you don't know whether or not the medium is genuine, and if she is genuine, how on earth could she possibly have known about these remains? I really liked how that was resolved inside of that narrative, and obviously I have no intention of spoiling it, but I really like that there was an uncommon tension around whether or not what she is telling them about the location of this body, whether or not it comes from her genuine innocent knowledge, and if it comes from her innocent knowledge, how in the hell does she know it?
Yes.
And that was very, very interesting for me, certainly. Because I think that's quite rare in this sort of fictional representation of these things.
It's a recurring theme, though. If you come across mediums and spiritualists in detective fiction, that aspect, are they real? Are they not real? Do they really? Is this real? Supernatural contact? Is a ghost actually communicating? And that, yeah. As a matter of fact, that exact aspect is something that I'm reading in a Carolyn Wells book called The Comeback that I didn't even know was going to be about mediums and spiritualists. And I had hoped to finish it in time for this podcast, but I haven't. But right now, that's what I'm going through. It's one of her earlier books. I like her earlier books. I don't like anything that's past 1925 that she wrote. and it's serious. It's very serious. I chose it because it features her con artist detective, Pennington Wise. And Pennington Wise has this female assistant named Zizi, Z-I-Z-I. And she used to be a stunt woman for the silent films, so she has an acting background, and she pretends that she's in many of their cases she pretends that she's a medium, But there is a real medium in the story as well. And there is a man who has lost his son, and he's disappeared in a snowstorm in Labrador when he was on a hiking trip. And the father has become, and as well as the mother, have become grief-stricken because they have never been able to recover the body. And the medium is coming up with all kinds of information that she couldn't possibly know because it's so private. And I'm guessing towards the end, the detective and his assistant are going to show her up somehow. Wells tends to like to rationalize all her supernatural stuff. I've never encountered a story where there's a real ghost in anything, although she's very skilled at making it seem real with her characters. You know, it's a talent that is hard to get on paper, I think, because there's just this inherent doubt among most people who read this kind of fiction generally just dismiss anything that involves the supernatural.
I find it interesting that you say within detective fiction, there's often that tension about how real or fake a medium might be. I presume you mean that from the character perspective, because as a reader, certainly in detective fiction, you never really doubt that these people are charlatans. It's just a matter of how it's going to be uncovered.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I guess because the way it's just my personal thing that I'm okay. Kind of like sometimes I want it to be sometimes I want it to be real. You know, because I have an affinity for supernatural fiction too. So when I'm not writing about detective fiction on pretty sinister books, I'm writing about horror fiction and ghost stories, and especially at Christmas time, I write a lot about the Victorian ghost stories that were published at Christmas time, and it's for me, it's kind of a nice surprise every now and then when you expecting the medium to be a fraud, and then they turn out to be. Have made actual contact with a dead person, and everybody's just like, oh my god.
Have you read, well, I can't believe I'm asking you a question that begins, have you? Sincerely apologize. You have of course read The Hand of Mary Constable by Paul Gallico.
I have not read it, but I've seen the movie.
In terms of the puzzle that it sets up, I do think that was one of the best. I know this is going to be fake, but how in the hell can this turn out to be fake? Like, that was one of the best walkings of that line I think I've ever come across. For anyone who hasn't read that book, essentially it involves a young girl called Mary Constable who has died, who makes contact through a medium, and her parents ask for some proof that it is indeed Mary who has got in touch. And at one particular seance, they have a block of melted wax. They turn the lights off. The medium makes contact with Mary. And when the lights come back up, there is, in the wax, there is an impression of a hand that has been thrust into the wax and solidified. And the markings on the palm and the fingerprints are all fully visible in the wax, and when they get these fingerprints checked out, they are indeed the fingerprints of Mary Constable. And it's an incredible mystery. It's an absolutely wonderfully baffling problem, because I think a lot of the time when it is simply a question of someone having a particular kind of knowledge, or certainly as detective fiction started to get a bit older and we started to see through more of the tropes and get better at, you know, not being misdirected away. What did Carr call it? The blood on a white handkerchief, didn't he? You know, and like this not being distracted by what you're supposed to be distracted by.
Right.
I think a lot of the mediumistic stuff can be quite easy to see through. It's incredibly enjoyable, but it still can be quite easy to see through. But that problem of this hand, obviously, that has been thrust into the wax, it's formed in such a way that the wax is unbroken, so it's this perfect impression of a hand, is such a brilliant problem. The resolution is unfortunately a little bit tame, or in the book at least. I imagine it's the same in the movie. I haven't seen the movie.
Well, he wrote, that's Paul Gallico, and he wrote an occult detective novel called Too Many Ghosts.
The Hand of Mary Constable is the sequel to that. There's a huge a change in like tonally in those books. In the first one, Hero turns up absolutely convinced that all of these ghosts manifesting in this hall is complete mummery. And he's got these tiny cameras and microphones, and it's almost mm-hmm. like a sort of a weird James Bondian kind of setup. He turns up with all these gadgets.
Oh, well, that's like Shirley, you know, those are like the people in the Shirley Jackson, who the parapsychologist who invited in Haunting of Hill House. I don't remember which one came first. It may be a reaction to that. There were a lot of books that followed Haunting of Hill House where people had these teams of parapsychologists, ghostbuster types, whatever. But your observation about the expecting the seance to be fake and expecting to the medium to be a trickster is an interesting one. Even though sometimes when I'm reading these books, I would I'm hoping that the ghosts are real. You can see, but I've read so many of them that, and I've also read the nonfiction books that Houdini and they're ghost written by Walter Gibson, who we just talked about earlier, Maxwell Grant. So all those spiritual debunking books where they exposed all the tricks, and I have so many of them, and I would pore over the pages and see how the stage magic was employed in the creation of phony seances. So they're completely intertwined. The fake seances actually grew out of being knowledgeable of stage illusions. And they're so intricate, the kinds of things that they came up with. And in fact, in some seances are nothing more than magic tricks. I mean, there's the whole thing with going into a spirit cabinet and the tambourines rattling and everything. And people actually paid a medium to contact their dead relative and then would be watching a magic show, basically. So I mean, that's how horrid it was, that they knew that they were so grief-stricken and they were so desperate for this contact that it didn't matter that they did something that egregiously phony.
Have you ever seen the TV series Inside Number 9?
Not ever heard of it, so no, I've not seen it.
Okay. Each one is half an hour long. They are entirely unconnected, apart from the fact that they are written by and star the same two people. You know, there are always different characters in each episode.
Okay.
And probably the best way to explain them is they are effectively like an updated version of Roald Dahl's Tales of the Unexpected.
Okay.
There are two that spring to mind. One of them, I believe, is called Seance Time. And it essentially concerns a man going to a house in order to contact the dead and getting involved in a seance. And I mean, the great thing about it is the way in which it builds from there and how it turns into something quite unexpected once you get beyond that. But that sort of shows up. I don't think it spoils anything to say that there's an element of fakery involved in the seance. And that shows up absolutely brilliantly, the way in which some of these tricks are used. And as you say, the way in which a lot of these things can be exploited. There is another one from the most recent series called Misdirection.
Oh, how about that?
Which is about, it starts off with two magicians. Well, actually, one of them is a magician and one of them is a fan of magic tricks. And the magician shows the fan this trick that he has developed, this levitation trick.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first couple of minutes, the fan kills him and steals his notebook and steals the trick. And then it cuts to several years later. And on the back of this trick, this fan has himself become an incredibly famous magician. And then he gets interviewed by a fan of magic, and so it is this sort of this reversal of the opening situation, and it uses again some very, very clever principles. What I really like about it is how it's set obviously in 21st century England, and it uses very classical ideas of magic and misdirection to achieve things. But it also uses some very modern and very updated things that, you know, wouldn't have been an option even 5 years ago, and stays very current with the kind of misdirection it's using.
Yes.
I think if you have an interest in magic in particular, Misdirection from Series 5 is certainly worth checking out.
Oh, I should.
From a seance perspective, Seance Time, I believe it's called, is the final episode of Series 2. It's not strictly about a seance, but that sort of explores some of the ideas behind faking a seance in a way that's very, very interesting.
Oh. That whole idea of the stealing the book is such a recurring motif. So much mystery fiction, and especially horror fiction, you know, the secret book that has so much power. Tell me the name of the series one more time. Is that 9? All I got, we remember, it's got 9
it's
in the title.
It's called Inside Number 9.
Inside Number 9. Speaking of TV series, in America, there was a one season only, and I remember it was when I was a teenager, in 1973, and it was The Magician, starring Bill Bixby. He's an American actor. You know, do you know him? Well, he was in The Incredible Hulk. I guess everybody knows him from The Incredible Hulk. He was on a TV show for the Incredible Hulk, and then he was My Favorite Martian, and I could go on forever. Anyway, Bill Bixby, he's a magician detective, basically. And in this case, he actually does, in every episode, use illusions to capture the criminals. The tricks were part of the plot, and there was always something that he did that, you know, he was a crime solver, basically. Archetypical amateur detective, was always stumbling upon crimes. And so that was a TV series. It only lasted one season, unfortunately. It was very imaginative. The guy who writes that, The Rap Sheet, is talks about vintage TV shows a lot. And then that's a show that he has written about quite a bit. I think there's a couple episodes on YouTube somewhere, perhaps. And
obviously, since we're talking about magical TV shows, we should probably just mention Jonathan Creek. I mean, you
Well, of course, right.
But we should probably just get into elements of Jonathan Creek.
There's one episode that I recall that I later found exactly the same plot in a short story by Melville Davison Post. And he was an early 20th century. And I'm always wondering if the writer had a few things that he took notes on. It's like, oh, I could probably elaborate on that. And that had a gorilla in it?
House of Monkeys.
Yeah, The House of Monkeys. Okay, yeah. So that the solution to that is almost exactly the same as the solution in a Melville Davison Post. I was reading the short story and I said, this is that Jonathan Creek episode. This is different. You know, the body is found in a locked room and the place is torn to smithereens. It's just a disaster, a wreck. And then nobody could have gotten in because the windows were barred and he was locked and the whole thing.
There were two, like, hour and a half, 2 hour special episodes that were on various Christmases over here. One of them takes place in Doomdorf Castle, it's called.
So he did know about Post.
So chances are that he was
aware knew Post.
Of Melville Davison Post's writing, yeah.
So yeah, yeah.
David Renwick, the guy who wrote Jonathan Creek, was himself a magician's, I don't know, imagineer is probably the best word for it. He helped.
Right, he designed the tricks?
Yeah. Before he was a writer for television. So, I mean, he knew a lot about that kind of stuff. Chances are that, as a designer of magic tricks, you probably read a certain amount about what has been done, right? Largely, I guess, because you don't want to repeat it. And so it might be that he picked up certain things in late 19th, early 20th century fiction involving magicians.
Right.
And was like, well, we can't do this on the stage because it's been done on the stage. But then, you know, after nearly a century later, there's absolutely no shame at all, is there, in using that in your TV plot, because you get to show it and be incredibly creative with it. I think I really like the idea that he got some of these ideas from these earlier stories. I think that's fascinating.
In reading those pulp stories and finding out more about Fulton Orsler's life, he was, like many of the writers that I was reading, a magician. He was fascinated with magic. He was associated with magicians. And he describes lots of stage illusions in those short stories that I read. And it was intriguing for me because I thought some of the things that I had seen Doug Henning perform when I was a teenager on TV, and Mark Wilson, who's also another American. These are all before David Copperfield. and David Blaine, who I can't stand. Some of these illusions that Doug Henning was doing are ancient. seriously, they all, they're just, they're slightly updated, but they go back to Houdini and before Houdini. The illusion where they switch body parts or they pull the middle section out of a woman, that's old. I never knew that. It was shocking to me to learn all of this stuff. That's part of the fascination for me now that I'm so much older reading these books, is learning things about pop culture, learning things about American history, learning things about world history in the context of the books that are just, you know, they're written, they're tangential comments.
Yeah.
That and I just go, what? Who? What? What is that? And put it down on a piece of paper, and then I go look it up later on and fall down the rabbit hole. And seriously, it's just like page after page. Really? Wow. There was a stereo that changed the records in the 1930s? It actually flipped the record for you? Anyway, so that's the K-part phonograph.
All right. What I might do is I might just drag it back towards a more kind of GAD-focused generality.
That's going to be your magic trick. So.
Okay, here we go. Do you think there's something about the duality of the performance, in inverted commas, required by crime fiction and the performance, not in inverted commas, of a magic trick that draws people who are knowledgeable about magic to write these kinds of stories?
Oh yes, that's really observational. It's insightful. The idea of performance, period, in fiction, especially detective fiction, has always been something that I draw analogies to, and maybe has a lot to do with my background too, because I was in theater for decades. But that's very true. The magician writers and all of the men that I talked about today, we have Clayton Rawson and Ken Crossan and Orsler and Haik Talbot. They were all magicians themselves. And the idea of fooling people. So detective fiction, in essence, is a game, you know, and you enter the world of a murder mystery, and you are hoping to match wits with the detective hero, and the whole crime solving part of it is pretty much like a stage act, and the detectives throughout the history of detective fiction are very much like actors and performers. I mean, they're full of themselves, you know, and there's that Holmes Watson pairing that has been modeled and reiterated. So the heroes are out there, and they're trying to show you what you should be looking at, but what you didn't see. And even the speech of these detective characters is oracular, you know, it's very enigmatic, and in the way that magicians have patter that's supposed to distract you from what they're doing with their hands. Yeah. It's a keen analogy. That's something I didn't think about before. And that's interesting to me because I use those theater analogies all the time. I talk about characters going on and off stage, things happening behind the curtain. I do that a lot.
There are examples of, and you have a great, I think, is it moonlighters, you call them? There are a lot of examples of people who wrote, for instance, one or only two detective fiction novels. And there are a few examples of these instances, with magicians, right? Talbot, as we say, only wrote two novels. Rawson wrote four, which in terms of magician authors makes him actually quite prolific.
And he had all those short stories too.
Those
little novellas, or the other character that he created was Don Diavolo, which we didn't get to talk about, but that's they're hard to find, so not very many people know about them.
One of my favorite impossible crime novels by a magician is one of these moonlighters, a guy called Bruce Elliott.
Right, and that he was friends with Ken Crossan. They were all in one huge circle.
Was friends with Ken? Well, yeah, I think it was a magic circle, wasn't it? Probably with a pentagram drawn in it or something.
Yeah, the book that I read by Ken Crossan all of the characters are named after his friends. So there's a policeman named Rawson. There's a character named whose last name is Bruce. There's another policeman who's named Elliot. He does that all the time.
Okay. I just like Elliot, as far as I'm aware, he wrote one novel called You'll Die Laughing and one short story called Death Paces the Widow's Walk, both of which involve some aspect of impossibility.
Right.
And I find it very interesting. I mean, I really like You'll Die Laughing. It is flawed. I maintain it's about two or three sentences away from being a masterpiece in the genre. If you were to just add the tiniest of touches to the central illusion, which is effectively a man disappearing from one room and reappearing almost instantaneously in another. There is you could add like two sentences, three sentences, and it would become a masterpiece and be far better. But I find it interesting that Elliot wrote two stories and then pretty much got out of it. And that, you know, Rawson wrote only a couple of stories and then got out of it. And Talbot wrote a couple of stories and Crossan and similarly. So you've got these people who obviously feel that they have some knowledge of the elements of performance and obviously of misdirection. And this marrying of misdirection on the stage and misdirection on the page would have been something that occurred to somebody at some point, because it's not easy to sit down and write a book. I can attest to that. I've been three chapters into mine for about the last 10 years. I just wonder if, is that it? Is it just the fact that magicians go, I'm good at misdirection, I can write a book that involves some misdirection?
It could be. There's definitely a competitive edge to in the world of magic. Who's going to who's going to outdo each other? Oh, I can top. Who can top one another? And I think there were these writing contests, you know, with each other. And they all knew one. They all knew one another. And I definitely remember that one of the Crossan novels that I wrote was dedicated to Bruce Elliott. And then, like I said, he name drops his characters as a huge in joke. And so there's that part of it too. And Hake Talbot probably knew to quit after the Rim of the Pit, because there's no way that he could top himself there. I mean, that's just, I mean, it's a classic now. It's, you know, here's this 21st century, 70 years later or so on, decades later. And he's very much, he had his hand in everything. I just found a website about his life, and I didn't know that he was, in addition to being a magician, he was a professor of theater. And so he taught technical theater. He wrote a textbook on stage design. And then there's another book that's I can't even remember what I should have written down all this kind of stuff, because I found his life to me became absolutely fascinating. And I all found it on one page of the internet. So he, obviously, his primary career took precedence over this kind of dabbling that he did.
Yeah.
But his dabbling is still something that is kind of the model of that subgenre of impossible crime fiction and magic in mystery.
Right, John, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. This is great. It's always, I love being able to talk to people who are this well-read about this particular enthusiasm of mine. This is
overread. That's my case.
I refuse to believe there's such a thing. Is I love being reminded just how much great stuff there is still out there.
Yes. Oh, good.
I do really appreciate you taking the time. So thank you so much. Thank you very much. Just do this again sometime.
Oh, well, I would love to.
All right. Thanks, John.
You're welcome. Bye bye.